1929 is generally seen as the end of the silent era. The jazz singer's handful of spoken passages were taken as a novelty during its 1927 release, but theaters started to bring in sound equipment soon afterwards. The first big screen musical films followed soon after, two partial talkies in 1928, and then after the smash success of the all-talkie Broadway Melody, almost 70 musicals were produced the following year. Hollywood soon canceled all their silent productions, and by the standards of film historians, this is generally seen as the beginning of the golden age of American cinema. Of course, this transition was far from frictionless, especially in countries where sound technology for filmmaking was unavailable, too expensive, or too advanced for local technicians to use properly. A handful of silent or partial talkie films trickled out throughout the 1930s, even if you don't count guys like Charlie Chaplin, who defied the changes of the times for luddite reasons. One of the most noteworthy examples of these historical aberrations is Vampyr, a movie that feels like a German expressionist horror film despite being released a year after Universal's versions of Frankenstein and Dracula. Vampyr is interesting for reasons other than its historical context, however. Its hallucinatory, dreamlike atmospherics and evocative imagery was not appreciated in its time, but movie dorks like me have taken it in our hearts ever since its qualities were reappraised in the 1990s. We'll be going into the how and why over the course of this recording. My name is Ryan. This is a real deep dive. All right, joining me on this one is my sister Cheryl.
Hello.
And also my sister Sarah.
Hello.
If it's not obvious, this was my pick.
Yeah, but I was really happy you showed it to me.
Yeah, I think this is the first time seeing it for both of you.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But I'm a dork for vampire stuff, so...
Yeah, although you were not a dork for the man shoveling backwards.
No. Yeah, that was, Well, he wasn't a vampire, though. He was like a cursed shadow.
Yeah, a lot of silhouette action in this one.
Yeah, the shadows did kind of confuse me, I'm not gonna lie.
There was a passage about them.
I had a little bit of a hard time following this one, but...
I mean, Vampyr is one of those movies that embraces surrealism and non-logic, and as such, forces you to have some kind of interpretation of it. And your interpretation, it quite very well could be, I don't get it. But anyways, plot recap. Perhaps the paragraphs will illuminate certain elements of this.
Yes, I was very much looking forward to this part.
Alright, on a late evening, a gentleman named Alan Gray arrives at an inn in an isolated French village, and he rents a room to sleep there. Gray is awakened suddenly by an old man, who enters the room and leaves a square packet on Gray's table, "to be opened upon my death," being written on the wrapping paper. Gray takes the passage and walks outside, and shadows guide him to an old castle, where he sees the shadows dancing and wandering on their own. Gray also sees an elderly woman, later identified as Marguerite Chopin, although Cheryl thought that this was the Quaker Oats man.
She does look a lot like the Quaker Oats man, just with a really fancy necklace.
It's true.
And I pointed out that it was a lady, and Cheryl's like, Carmilla is the Quaker Oats man in this. They took some liberties. Also, Gray encounters a different old man, later identified as the village doctor, but according to Cheryl, it's if Corey Feldman played Mark Twain.
Which I will say is spot fucking on for how that man looks.
Agreed. I thought he was supposed to look like a mix between Mark Twain and Einstein.
Gray leaves the castle and walks to a manor. Looking through one of the windows, Gray sees the lord of the manor, who is the same man who gave him the package earlier. This man is suddenly murdered by gunshot from a silhouette.
Shadow shot.
Gray is led into the house by servants who rush to the aid of the fallen man, but it is too late to save him. The servants ask Gray to stay the night for some reason, where he encounters Giselle, the younger daughter of the now-deceased lord of the manor. She takes Gray to the library and tells him that her sister, Leone, is gravely ill. Just then they see Leone walking outside. They follow her and find her unconscious on the ground with fresh bite wounds. The Quaker Oats lady was hovering over her ominously. They have her carried inside, and Gray remembers the parcel at this point and opens it, since, you know, the instruction was to open it upon his death. The parcel contains a book about horrific demons called Vampyr, who can force humans into submission through hypnotic powers and supernatural strength.
I just want to pause and stress that the man that got murdered had this book. He had this resource, and this is the path that he chose. All right, keep going.
By reading the book, Gray realizes that Leone is the victim of a vampire. The village doctor visits Leon at the mansion, and Gray recognizes him as the old man he saw in the castle. The doctor tells Gray that a blood transfusion is needed, and Gray agrees to donate his blood to save Leon, although he does not give verbal agreement. He just kind of like goes along with it. This is what Gray does a lot. He just goes along with stuff. Exhausted from the blood loss, Gray falls asleep. Meanwhile, the oldest of the servants of the manor also reads the book and learns that a vampire can be defeated by driving an iron bar through its heart.
I'm gonna also interrupt and say this man was my favorite part of this movie, MVP.
Gray wakes up sensing danger and rushes to Leon's bedside, where he surprises the doctor as he is attempting to manipulate the girl into drinking poison.
Because the book said that if you're the victim of a vampire, you have to commit suicide, or like you're strongly encouraged to commit suicide by the vampire, so that like a devil will be happy.
Yeah, this will damn the person further.
Yeah,
also,
that's a new one for me from vampire lore. I'm not familiar with that part.
Also, the book flat out says, you know what? Vampires like to Renfield up some village doctor to assist. Still takes them surprisingly long to figure out that the doctor's working for the vampire.
Oh my god, it's great. Like, every time you get a little passage from the book, it's more like, hey, it's this town you're in. Hey, it's that lady you saw. Hey, it's that doctor you saw.
Hey, look behind you.
Right?
Be careful of the shadows. You'll get shadow shot.
But also, still, like, the dad legitimately told the nun that was staying with them, stay with my daughter until the doctor arrives. The nighttime doctor. And anyway, I had this book that would be super helpful, and theoretically I read. But anyway, that doctor's fine to be in this house.
The doctor flees the manor, and Gray finds that Giselle is also gone. Gray follows the doctor back to the castle, but before reaching it, he has an out-of-body experience on a park bench and sees himself dead and being buried by Marguerite Chopin and the doctor.
Oh my gosh, the shots in that scene were so good. That man is very good at keeping his eyes open while being carried in a coffin full of sawdust and just like jostled around. That was so much fun.
After he returns to his own body, Gray sees the old servant heading to Marguerite Chopin's grave.
The MVP servant.
Yeah, they open the grave together and find the old woman perfectly preserved. They then hammer a large metal bar through her heart, killing her, and therefore lifting the curse of the vampire. Leone suddenly recovers at this point. The ghost of the lord of the manor appears as a giant head to the doctor, chasing him away from his house and killing the soldier who was helping him. Gray rescues Giselle, who was being held tied up by the doctor. The doctor then hides in an old plaster mill, but finds himself locked in a chamber where the flour sacks are filled. The old servant arrives and activates the mill's machinery, filling the chamber with flour and suffocating the doctor.
The true hero of this story. He's the one that drove the stake. He went to that grave all on his own. Alan just fucking fumbled Mr. Magoo's his way into the plot points. But this guy's like, oh, gotta roll up my sleeves and handle this with my rheumatoid arthritis.
Do we ever find out the doctor's, like, motivation or, like, reason?
He got Renfielded in her with the lady's service.
Okay, alright.
The book says, too, that, like, there are some people that will sell their souls to the devils, and in exchange, they have to serve vampires. So that's, like, his deal.
Gotcha. Okay. Alright.
Anyways, while the doctor is suffocating, Giselle and Gray cross a foggy river by boat and find themselves in a bright clearing, which is where the movie ends. Well, the gears of the mill stopping. That is our final shot.
Yep, they're both just like very swelling music.
So anyways, that's Vampire. And for the development of this, writer-director Carl Theodore Dreyer began planning his next project roughly a year after the massive critical success and horrific commercial failure of The Passion of Joan of Arc, a film generally seen as his magnum opus in retrospect and something that routinely appears on greatest movies ever made lists even today. However, once again, because it failed, his production company dropped him, and he had to look for outside studio help to get this one together. France was struggling to adapt to the advent of talkies, so Dreyer traveled to England to learn how to direct a sound film. He hooked up with fellow Dane Christian Juhl, and taking note of the popularity of Dracula's theatrical production in England in 1927, decided to make a supernatural horror film, thinking that it'd be a little more commercial than the stuff that he was doing beforehand. Dreyer and Juhl read dozens of horror fiction and gothic mystery stories, taking note of recurring tropes like creaking doors and inanimate objects moving on their own. Their biggest source turned out to be In a Glass Darkly, a story compilation by Irish writer Joseph Thomas Sheridan Le Fanu.
That was a mouthful.
Yeah. The room in the Dragon Volant, which is about a live burial, inspired the movie's climax.
Ugh.
However, the aspect of In a Glass Darkly that influenced Vampyr the most was Carmilla, a novella where a young girl is targeted by a sapphic vampire, and that supplied a number of other springboards for Jewel and Dreyer. Carmilla was originally serialized from 1871 to 1872 in the literary magazine The Dark Blue. It's an early example of lesbian vampire fiction, a device employed in exploitation media throughout the 20th century in order to shock and or titillate audiences while slipping around regional censorship codes.
Yay!
Carmilla is also loosely adapted in Universal's 1936 film Dracula's Daughter, which kept the lesbian subtext that Dreyer removed in this version, amongst many, many other things.
That's the one where they have her, like, much older, right?
Dracula's Daughter is a bit matronly, but much younger than the vampire in this movie.
Not the Quaker Oats lady.
Yeah. Blood and Roses in 1960, Crypt of the Vampire in 1963, The Vampire Lovers in 1970, The Blood Spattered Bride in 1972, and Carmilla from 2019 adapt the novella more directly, although Drew Barrymore starred in a sort of Carmilla adaptation called Poison Ivy, but the vampire stuff was removed.
How do you do Carmilla without vampires?
Well, she's more of like a femme fatale seductress. Carmilla appears in numerous other derivative works. She is the second most popular cinematic vampire, although it's a steep drop after number one. Destiny, Shadows in Hell, and The Strange Adventures of David Gray were working titles before Vampyr was settled upon.
I like The Strange Adventures of David... What was it? Not David Gray, Mr. Gray?
Nope, David Gray.
David Gray. He got a new name.
Yeah.
It sounds like the title of a detective novel.
I would read the fuck out of that.
Might have been why they dropped it. Dreyer returned to France once it was time to scout locations and cast the actors. A big shift was when Dreyer was introduced to Baron Nicholas de Gunzburg, the son of a wealthy Russian family that had fled to France during the Tsar's anti-Jewish pogroms. The Baron agreed to fund Vampyr in exchange for playing Alan Grey, the lead role.
He was a handsome man.
Yeah, he did a good job.
He was billed as Julian West due to his family's objections to acting. They considered it commoner's work.
Ooh.
Yeah, they were that rich. Most film critics, especially the modern ones, consider the Baron to be not much of a thespian, but Dreyer compensated by instructing the Baron to perform his actions like a sleepwalker, thus playing into the dreamlike qualities of the narrative.
I mean, I agree with that. I didn't think he was a bad actor. I just thought it was a trippy movie.
Yeah, he just kept fumbling into one scene after the next. As Cheryl put it, the older servant did most of the actual moving and shaking.
It was so much fun. I loved it.
And he did have, like, almost, like, the same facial expression, like, every scene. He was very...
surprised and concerned.
Yes, which, you know, he should be.
The whole time.
The whole
there
time.
Was no break in the surprise and concerning events.
Exactly. So, you know, it worked. He just didn't do a whole lot.
He played dead really well.
The Baron moved to America after the family fortune dried up. He made connections in the fashion industry and became an editor for Vogue.
Ooh!
Among other things, he was a mentor to Calvin Klein. This is his only acting performance.
Well, good for this man. It sounds like he had a very full life.
For the most part, Dreyer cast non-actors for the other major roles in Vampyr. Pretty much nobody appeared in another movie besides this. John Hieronymko, who played the village doctor, was some guy that Dreyer spotted while riding the train and decided that he should be the doctor.
That's awesome.
It took some effort for Dreyer to convince Hieronymko that he was seriously a film director and he was seriously trying to cast him in his vampire movie.
It's like when you go to the mall and they're like, no, you should be a model, for real.
Like, it was just mostly staring at Dreyer blankly for a few minutes.
Yeah, because if somebody just walks up to you and is like, hey, so I'm making a movie about vampires and I want you to be the villain. And they're like, what?
But not the main villain. That's a lady.
Yeah, no, you're just going to be their, like apprentice. Or lackey. Really, it's a lackey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Head lackey. Lackey number one.
Yes.
Maurice Schutz, who played the Lord of the Manor, the old man with the giant head and after he's dead.
Oh, yeah, big head!
And Sybil Schmitz, who played the bedridden Lyonne, you know, the Lucy Westerna figure in this.
I thought she did a really good job.
Yeah, they were the only experienced actors in the movie.
She did a solid leer. Like, her just being like, I'm gonna bite you, sis. That was good.
Schmitz's career took a turn when she began appearing in Nazi propaganda films throughout World War II. She was shunned by the film industry after the war, developed a morphine addiction, and committed suicide when her money ran out.
I have conflicted feelings. That's just, I mean, that's still sad, but also, fuck you.
Schutz appeared in many films before and after Vampyr. His total roster is apparently 91, which spans from 1918 to 1952.
1918 is my favorite year. This man is just good luck.
And his big old head. Most of the Joan of Arc crew returned for Vampyr, including cinematographer Rudolf Maté and art director Herman Worm. Both would be crucial to Vampyr's look.
Well, they did a good job because that movie was great. Very groovy.
You particularly liked the chase scene where they're going after Leone because it's reflected in the water, and yeah, it was just a very nice shot.
Yeah, it really was.
To save money, most of Vampyr was shot on location in the French countryside. Cast and crew bunked up in the decrepit castle seen in the film. It was drafty, run down, and infested with rats, so everybody was pretty miserable by the end of the shoot.
Oh my god, they couldn't even get, like, I mean, I guess you wouldn't have a trail. There's no, like, house somebody could have rented?
Nope.
Ugh.
The script called for the village doctor to sink to his death in a swamp, but Dreyer changed his mind about that when he came across a plaster mill. Dreyer liked the white doors and the windows and decided, you know what, this guy's drowning in flour instead.
I mean, it was really cool, especially those big giant, like, cogs. That was just gorgeous.
I mean,
it was a very interesting death.
Yeah, even after decades upon decades of horror movies, the Doctor's death in Vampyr is still a very singular and unique kill scene in a horror movie. The church scene in the movie was actually an old barn that they gussied up and added fake tombstones to.
Oh, I like that!
Dreyer planned for a Vampyr to be heavy and dark at first, but he changed course when he saw Maté's rushes one day and noticed that one take was a bit fuzzy and out of focus. He loved how surreal and dreamy it looked, and shot the rest of the movie with a layer of gauze 3 feet from the camera lens in order to replicate the effect.
Huh.
I mean, that's really fine. I wonder if that's, like, because I honestly thought it was, like, double exposure all over the place.
There is double exposure all over the place. A big thing that Dreyer introduced in Vampyr is that he really wanted to make a movie that wasn't all that much like anything he had done beforehand. If you watch this back-to-back with Passion of Joan of Arc, you can see parallels, but Dreyer isn't a guy who uses the same visual vocabulary in film after film. It's really more of a thematic through line that goes through all of his work.
I really like that a lot. That must make him a very interesting, like, director to see the movies up. Is it just the two?
He has 14 movies. 9 of them are in the silent era.
Ooh. We're gonna have to do another one.
Yeah, I really want to see the Joan of Arc one.
While Dreyer did pick up some knowledge about talkies, he nonetheless envisioned Vampyr as a silent film. Dialogue was kept to a minimum, and most of the narrative was carried by title cards, particularly the reading sequences. And we act sure that since, you know, our main hero is a sleepwalker, essentially, he reads those captions real slow.
So slow! Oh my god!
It got to the point where it was like, how many times can I read this page before it cuts away?
Right? Line. Line? Come on!
I think I actually, like, closed my eyes a few times and was like, it's still on the screen. It was on for a while.
It's been a few years since I've seen Vampyr. I was under the impression that there was even less dialogue than there was. This is a very visual-based narrative.
Yeah.
Which is really cool.
Actors mouth their few lines in French, German, and English so it could be dubbed in later. Separate voice actors dubbed in virtually all of the dialogue for the cast. This is reminiscent of Italian filmmaking years later. Schmitz and Günzburg were the only ones who supplied their own voices. It is not known if the English version of Vampyr was ever completed, much less shown. We only have the French and German ones to work from. Francisco Goya was a pronounced influence on the film's aesthetic. Raina Mandel, who played Giselle, recalled that Dreyer asked her to pose like figures in the Goya paintings through her various scenes, particularly the running through the field part.
Oh my gosh, that's so cool. I wish you'd told me that before. I would have, like, looked for it.
Yeah, among other things, Dreyer was a big classical art buff, so yeah, there's always, like, some Renaissance stuff going on there, Greek sculpture, so on and so forth. For the post-production of this, editing and audio work was done at UFA, since it had the best sound tech in Europe at the time. We talked about UFA in previous episodes. Animal noises were made by human voice actors. They did not fool Cheryl.
No.
They're like, dogs and children? I have not heard dogs nor children. The original score for this film was composed by Wolfgang Zeller. It is very eerie and evocative and appropriate to the film, and while it is carrying a lot of the narrative, at the same time, it's also kind of a secret weapon.
Oh my gosh, especially the scenes where it just cuts out entirely. I'm like, wait, what? And then it just boom, and it was right back. I liked that a lot.
Yeah, it takes you out a little bit, and then it throws you back in. Zeller has almost 50 credits between 1926 and 1959. He never worked for Hollywood, weirdly enough. However, like Seville, he also worked for the Nazis. But he was apparently forgiven, and even got a job scoring the anti-fascist 1947 film Marriage in the Shadows.
So he just changed his mind?
Well, it could be one of those situations where he was vetted by anti-fascist groups after the war ended, and they were just like, well, I guess it wasn't great that you scored movies for the Nazis, but eh, whatever. You're not a war criminal.
Okay, I guess.
But apparently that didn't apply to other people who appeared in Vampire. There are some differences between the French and German edits. Alan Gray is named David Gray in the German version.
Oh, I like the title!
Yeah, Dreyer said that this was a translation error. The village doctor's death and the stabbing of the vampire are toned down significantly in the German edit of the film.
Aw, come on, but the stabbing was really cool.
We watched the 2008 Criterion version, which is the German cut of the movie, but with all the naughty stuff added back in.
Yay!
Scenes of a vampire recoiling from the shadow of a crucifix in the mill were cut. Also removed was a scene of children building a bonfire to guide Gray and Giselle back to the shore at the end of the movie, while they sing a hymn, sort of like, hey, we're singing here, go through the fog.
Oh, I liked the hello version instead.
Both scenes are now lost.
Aww.
All right, for the release and reception of this, the German release was delayed by UFA on account of Universal's Dracula and Frankenstein getting dubbed in German and released there.
Yeah, I can see this not competing as great with those.
German audiences booed the film at its premiere, spurring Dreyer to recut Vampire for its French release. Reception there was frosty, but at least nobody jeered or walked out to the point where they had to stop playing the movie.
That's harsh. This movie was good.
In Vienna, a riot broke out when a theater refused to give refunds to a mob of irate patrons. Police were forced to be called in, and they subdued the violent crowd with batons.
This movie was not that bad. Those people are way too dramatic.
Yeah.
I liked this movie, but I've never hated a movie so much that I had to, like, start a riot. I just walked out.
Dreyer, despondent over the Vienna riots and the German booing, did not bother to attend the Danish or American premieres. Vampire was a commercial failure, and contemporary reviews were brutal, with many calling the movie incoherent and unintentionally hilarious.
What assholes?
Dreyer had a nervous breakdown and had to be hospitalized.
Poor man.
He was also considered unemployable for a while. For the next 10 years, we don't exactly know what Dreyer was up to. He did not direct again until the 1942 short Good Mothers. His next feature was 1943's Day of Wrath.
It's not like he was Ed Wood. Like, I liked his movie.
For decades afterwards, Vampire was considered the weakest point in Dreyer's catalog, although, once again, it was reappraised in the 1990s, and it has a Criterion edition, so it's considered a masterpiece by at least some film snobs.
I know, but it's so sad because it didn't happen while this guy was alive. Don't tell me that man was alive in the 90s.
No, he was not.
Okay.
Anyways, that brings us to themes. The first thing I brought up was atmospherics over production values.
Yay!
While made well after the German expressionist movement in filmmaking peaked, Vampire takes several lessons from forebears like Nosferatu and the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. While France, and especially Germany, built relatively robust film industries while making propaganda films during World War I, neither could afford to furnish their movies with the razzle-dazzle of Hollywood, so other methods were sought to create memorable, dynamic film images. The heart of expressionism, as I've mentioned in prior episodes, lies in art reflecting not actual reality, but the psychological interiority of the artist and or the subject. In painting, this meant arbitrary color choices and exaggerated anatomy. In film, this means that you can get away with cheap, fake-looking sets as long as the movie acts like this is supposed to be symbolic of something.
Which I agree with 100%. I mean, what's your favorite kind of Batman movie? It's the one that's all campy and crazy.
Budget-conscious filmmakers have, and still do, work from this template. Italian giallo films of the 1960s and 70s, slasher movies with lots of saturated light that covers up a lack of set dressing, pretty much everything that Tim Burton did before CGI became affordable. You get the idea.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, as I mentioned, Dreyer did not have access to even UFA after the failure of Joan of Arc, so him making creative choices like this was at least partially motivated by necessity. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that he didn't use this as a springboard to be creative. Robert Rodriguez talks about this quite a bit when he's discussing what it was like to make El Mariachi, and a whole bunch of shots that ended up looking really cool because he couldn't afford to do them properly.
Necessity is the mother of creativity or something?
Yeah, mother of invention, but yes, you get the idea.
Butchered it.
Yeah, this is a story I've told several times, but I've heard this from a crew member who was working on a fairy tale TV movie, and they couldn't afford to have the fairies levitate, so instead they had them, like, stand on a seesaw and just had them, like, float up and down just out of frame, and it was actually a super cool-looking shot.
That's really delightful.
So yeah, plenty of that in Vampire. You know, you don't have, like, an explosive rendered backlot job, but you got a giant head in the window, or some dude standing on the shoreline with a scythe.
Okay, that guy was pretty bitchin', but, like, also, too, like, as much as I didn't like the backwards shoveling, I liked the backwards shoveling.
Cheryl likes corny things, campy things.
Careful.
How would you describe that?
I would say be very careful with your words.
That's why I'm trying to find a word for it.
Unless you want to wake up with cats being thrown.
Anyways, the next subject I wanted to bring up was Vampire's place in the evolution of vampire cinema. Vampire was a common buzzword in silent era filmmaking, but most of the time it was employed as a colorful synonym for gold digger. There's even a lampshade joke about this in Dracula's Daughter, which came out in 1936, well after the silent era was over.
Oh, I had no idea.
As far as we can tell, Vampire is only the third feature-length movie to employ the undead blood-sucking vampire as found in popular folklore. That is a big caveat, though, because, once again, as comes up in every single film in this era that we cover in the podcast, somewhere between 70 to 80% of all films made before 1928 are lost, so who knows, there might be other vampire movies out there. Oh, well, not out there anymore.
Maybe they are, though. Maybe they're in someone's basement. They're gonna, like, cut them all together and we get to see them again.
I mean, every now and then we do stumble across something, but in reality, yeah, most of the stuff is already lost. Those things are made on silver nitrate.
No.
Anyways, it isn't that much of a shock that there's a paucity of vampire movies in the first few decades of cinematic storytelling, since the literary vampire is also a relatively recent phenomenon. The earliest known vampire story outside of folk tales is John Polidori's 1819 short The Vampire, composed as part of the same Lord Byron contest that yielded Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. So this is recent. Polidori's monster was a playful caricature of Lord Byron, leading to the trope of the pompous aristocratic vampire that appears in everything from Dracula to Interview.
Delightful.
You just put Lestat in with Dracula, and that made me weirdly happy.
I mean, they're both pompous, aristocratic, buffoonish vampires.
Anything making fun of Lord Byron makes me happy.
1847's Varney the Vampire was the first novel, albeit a cheap, serialized one centering on a vampire.
His name was Varney?
Yes.
Is that like a precursor to...
The dinosaur?
No, I was gonna say a precursor to, like, comic book names like Peter Parker.
Varney the Vampire.
Well, I mean, Stan Lee said that he used alliteration in most of his superhero aliases because he had an easier time remembering it that way.
Of course he did.
So maybe Varney the Vampire is the same way.
I wonder if Varney the Vampire had veneers.
Well, he does end his vampiric curse by throwing himself into Mount Vesuvius.
That seems a little extra. Like, there were easier things to do.
Is Mount Vesuvius nearby to where he is?
I there.
Does he travel to throw himself into Mount Vesuvius?
To be honest, it's hundreds of pages long, and it's considered crap, so I've never tried to read Varney the Vampire.
I have no desire, but...
Maybe Varney the Vampire is the vampire of Mount Vesuvius, and so, like, it was really convenient.
I bet we could write a better fan fiction story about Varney the Vampire than the actual story of Varney the Vampire.
I just really enjoy saying Varney the Vampire.
I wonder how many times we can say it during this podcast.
Well, I'm already in theme, so there's not much time left. Because of its early appearance in horror movie history, as well as Dreyer's eagerness to experiment, Vampyr can't help but anticipate several trends in vampire movies to follow. It's arguably the first film to portray a reluctant vampire fighting against their own bloodlust.
Oh, what was her name? Leon?
Leona, yeah. You know, the whole, I've been corrupted, if only if I could die, the part where she just sort of, like, fancifully stares at the poison bottle and fights against herself. Speaking of lust, it's clearly the first film to include an element of erotic temptation alongside the threat of a vampire bite.
When?
Well, Leona and Giselle both give meaningful looks at Alan, who doesn't seem to notice. Once again, it's a bit of a reach, but it's there. It's there in ways that aren't in Nosferatu, since Count Orlok is essentially vermin in human form.
Yeah, and I mean, they give a lot of, like, meaningful looks both to the camera and other members of the cast. They very much act with their faces. They are 100%.
Like, she looked like she was down to, like, chow on her sister. I didn't really see her looking to, like, bite Alan.
There's eroticism in the subtext of the looks in Vampyr that aren't in Nosferatu. Nosferatu or Dracula.
Well, I mean, Dracula's not exactly hot, throwing that out there.
Well, I mean, the disco Dracula of the 70s movie is pretty hot.
I'm so intrigued by that. What? did you say disco Dracula?
Oh, yeah, there's a 1970s remake of Dracula that Universal produced, and it has a lot of, like, disco fashion in it, and it has a John Williams score.
Okay.
Who plays Dracula?
No.
Frank Langella.
Why haven't we watched this yet?
To be honest, I like it more on paper than I do in execution.
Oh, bummer.
And it is really, really weird to see chase scenes with Dracula, and you're expecting, like, the Millennium Falcon to show up.
Okay, but that just means you need to have more people in a room. The worse the movie is, the more people you have there, and then it's a great experience.
Actually, lots of people love 70s disco Dracula. I'm kind of an aberration.
I mean, I can't remember. Did you like Phantom of the Paradise?
Yes, I did.
Oh, okay. I love Phantom of the Paradise, and that's kind of my barometer for, like, disco era movies.
You don't say.
Anyway, speaking of the other stuff, Nosferatu eliminates the harem of vampires from the Dracula novel it unofficially adapts, while Todd Browning's Dracula movie for Universal reduces the brides of Dracula to extras. Lucy and Mina's vampiric desires are either reduced or eliminated in both of the films, so Vampyr is essentially the patient zero for the female vampire in cinema.
Okay, I mean, I thought you did an awesome job.
Yeah.
Yeah, after Dracula's daughter, dominant lady vampires were scarce in Western film until the 1960s. Much of what then came was highly reflective of the sexual revolution, sometimes for feminist purposes, but usually for exploitation purposes. As we've already touched upon, the thirsty, seductive, and frequently lesbian vampire could provide titillation with a veneer of plausible deniability for the regional censor.
I mean, works for me. Get some more sexy lady vampire lesbians out there.
Well, it also goes into a lot of pulpy lesbian fiction that existed in the first half of the 20th century that frames the lesbian as a tragic figure who has to either die or renounce lesbianism by the climax of the story, and how early lesbian writers had to frame their personal stories around those tropes as best they could. And it's a weird tension, especially since, you know, for most of it, it's like lesbianism is evil, but isn't it hot?
Did the characters choose to die a lot?
Yes, there's good. A lot of suicide in lesbian fiction.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Correct choice.
Anyways, that brings me to my final point. Vampyr as a religious allegory. Dreyer was, unlike the stereotypical image of the arrogant, bombastic, and larger-than-life auteur film director, a reserved, quiet, unassuming, and gentle man by most accounts of him.
Aw, that's nice!
He also had strong moral convictions derived from his religious upbringing. That makes him an unlikely choice for a grisly horror movie, which likely influenced Vampyr's reliance on visual symbolism rather than gore. None of the vampires in Vampyr sport fangs, although that wouldn't be a common feature in cinematic vampirism until Christopher Lee sported them in the Hammer Dracula movies. But once again, there's no elaborate makeup to make anyone look undead. They're essentially people who give frantic looks at the camera, as opposed to the non-vampire humans who are essentially sleepwalking.
Mm-hmm. One thing I did notice, too, is the vampire bite's location. That lady bit Adam's apples right on the front.
Yeah, I mean...
She bit your windpipe. She didn't bite anywhere else, which is kind of effective when you think about it, because your victims can't scream.
Yeah. The blood must be difficult to get around your windpipe. It's no...
Whatever. Eh. She made it work.
Film professor Marc LeFanu, who specializes in how Christian themes are interpreted in film, unsurprisingly frames Vampyr as a meditation upon Dreyer's spiritual beliefs. And yes, LeFanu claims that he is descended from the author of Carmilla. It is not difficult to make a case for this sort of argument. Vampyr lifts many aesthetic flourishes from the deeply religious Joan of Arc biopic that Dreyer had recently poured everything he had into. LeFanu adds that Vampyr could be seen as the inverse of the exalted, joyous resurrection that Dreyer depicts in 1955's Ordette. Thematically speaking, vampirism is frequently used to examine the flip side of divine resurrection in Christian mythos. Gary Oldman's vampire in Bram Stoker's Dracula is baldly framed as a bizarro Jesus, an undead freak that corrupts humanity by stealing their blood and body for himself. He even quotes Mark in his death scene.
Not anywhere near as like impressive as that, but Dracula 2000.
Oh yeah, where he's Judas.
Oh my gosh.
And the reason he doesn't like silver is because of the silver pieces. And like, you're watching, as a kid, that fucking blew my mind. As an adult, I'm like, this is stupid.
It blew my mind too, and actually, I still kind of like it.
I mean, I enjoy that, but isn't silver the thing for werewolves? Not.
No, it's for vampires.
It's for vampires too?
Moving water, rice on the ground, like, the things.
The reason a vampire can't see their own reflection is because back in the day, there was silver in mirrors.
Yep.
Oh. Okay.
The out-of-body sequence in Vampyr is probably the spiritual highlight of the film, and it leads one to question the concept of an immortal soul surviving bodily death being a good thing. Because, you know, watching yourself being carried out by the people who murdered you, kind of skeevy.
Well, but he ran and hid in the basement.
Yes, but he was also watching himself.
It was a lot.
Yeah, there was a lot of Allens floating about.
I lost track of them.
And I think that points out to something that Dreyer brings up in other works of his, that if it is oblivion that follows us after death, that is beyond the scope of human understanding and therefore terrifying to us. But in a way, so is eternity. We can't really grasp the idea of eternity. And for a lot of people, enduring forever can be terrifying as well.
Jump cut to all of Anne Rice's vampires, except Lestat.
And yeah, plenty of vampire movies are about, hey, do you think this resurrection is actually a good thing? And Vampyr is definitely one of those. So anyways, that's everything in my notes. Is there anything that either of you would like to say about Vampyr before we close things out?
Oh my god, the makeup of that movie. It was so lovely. You've got like a fresh face, like Judy Garland kind of character with Leon. Leon?
I've been going with Leon.
And then you've got like that like old like arched thin eyebrow like chunky mascara look with her sister Giselle. Ugh, I was just very happy. And then like the like slicked pomade like soaked hair of Alan. I very much enjoyed the aesthetic of this whole movie.
Yeah, I'm not surprised he edited Vogue later on. He's quite the dandy.
Right? I was like, ooh.
And Giselle is straight out of 1920s German expressionist cinema.
100%, yeah. The music was fantastic.
One thing that I don't think Alan was celebrated enough for was all of the fucking running he did in that suit, like, over grass. Like, I was dying laughing the one time he fell, because, like, there's no way that man didn't fall, like, over 100 times during shooting this movie.
Especially all those sleepless nights in the rat-infested castle.
Yuck.
Yeah, you said, it is difficult to run in the suit, and then he fell down.
I know, it was a really good timing.
Yeah, excellent synergy there. All right, well, if that's it, thank you for listening to everybody, and join us next time.